are listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 35 is, what is the self? For which we read George Friedrich Wilhelm Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit from 1807, specifically Part B, or Chapter 4, Self-Consciousness. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, in myself, from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, being for another, in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allwyn, achieving satisfaction from other self-consciousnesses in Boston, Massachusetts.
And this is Tom McDonald. I'm sublating all the moments of experience up to this point in New York.
That might be the first time that every single person used something relevant to the reading as their intro.
Well, I've been listening to you guys, so I'm studied up.
Yes. Yeah. Welcome, Tom.
Yeah, welcome.
What is your deal, Tom? Why are you here?
Well, I think I posted it to your site, and then you found my blog, and I had a lot of stuff on Hegel in my blog. But I think my situation is a little bit like your guys. Like, I work in something completely unrelated to this, but I do it outside as a passion. And I think that's what I find really attractive about your podcast, is that it has a kind of energy that I think is not the same in an academic type of context. So, you know, I relate to what you guys are doing.
Yeah, and you do a lot of volunteer discussion groups in New York City?
I run some meetup groups. So on meetup.com, I don't know if have you guys heard of Meetup?
Yeah, I have. Yep.
So I have the NYC Philosophical Reading and another group called NYC Film and Philosophy. Both of them are semi-regular, and we get quite a significant group of people. We get some people who've got a lot of background in this, some people who are complete newcomers. So I have some experience, too, with trying to find that place where you can have a discussion about these things that is not completely, you know, off the farm.
And you guys actually tried to read Hegel's Phenomenology, like, from the beginning with the group of beginners you were mentioning?
This was a couple summers ago. It was not my group. It was another meetup group. It was kind of the one that inspired me to start my own. And we tried to read the Phenomenology from beginning to end. And it was really hellacious. It actually came to fistfights because you have... As a matter of fact, I was kicked out of the group. And actually, Sean, if you're listening, yes, you know, I'm here. I'm still talking about the Phenomenology. It was an interpretive difference that we have. I mean, there's so many different ways to interpret this book. We got into a debate as to whether you read it logically or historically. And I'm sure this will come up in our discussion right now.
I think this is the only time it will come up.
This is an object lesson to you children out there. Philosophy does matter. These are not simply abstract conversations with nothing at stake. People can literally come to blows over ideas.
Are they coming to blows because the ideas matter in themselves, or coming to blows in the same way people come to blows over which football team is better?
Right.
Elevating the triviality of the material to an emotional tone.
Now, I suspect given the material, they probably came to blows over the life and death struggle between Lord and Bondsman.
It was perhaps suppressed consciously, but that might have been the dynamic that was going on under the surface.
You were enacting the reading, as psychoanalysts like to say.
Has this book ever been done as a musical?
It should be.
Interpretive dance.
I think if it is done as a musical, it should be done as some kind of kabuki theater.
Because it seems very artistic to me, the motion of the forms and the swishing about and the language. Like, it seems like it's almost like a verbal painting.
Well, that would be fitting. Hegel is part of the romantic moment. And I don't want to violate any rules here. It's probably be hard for me not to make references to, like, specific texts.
Hey, we should do the rules so we can have it very clearly in mind and point it out every time you violate it.
Okay.
Our ground rules are... Number one, try not to assume that our audience has read what we're talking about or has any other background in philosophy. Two, don't name drop. Just make your point. Don't say, you'd understand me if only you'd read Bob and Doug McKenzie's account of the history of democracy in Egypt. Take off you hosni. Three, be rigorous and exact in all that you say, instead of talking like that evil bastard Hegel. And before we get too far into this, I wanted to thank, we had a few people donate through the donate button this week. Russ Baker, Nick Beer, and just a few minutes ago, Light Luxor. I don't know if that's a name or what. But you'll help our hosting, and other people are welcome to do that as well. Let me ask you one more question. Tom, did you start sort of self-taught, or did you take a big load of this in college or whatever to get you the taste first of it?
I really got into philosophy, you know, as a freshman. I think it was like Western Civilization 101. And we did the Greeks and we read the Republic. And that's what I really got nipped with philosophy. But I didn't do it as a major. I did media studies, which was kind of theory oriented, but it was kind of postmodernism. And we read like Foucault,
wow,
cultural studies type of approach. So there was definitely philosophy there, especially the kind of post-structuralism and that sort of thing. But I was always interested in philosophy proper, too. So I've just maintained it, you know. And it's been so many years now that even though I don't have the formal training, I've read a lot of stuff.
Well, and you said you, a couple of years ago, just read a whole bunch of secondary sources on Hegel's phenomenology in particular as part of that seminar, or?
Yeah, that was a couple of years ago we read this book. And ever since, I've been reading tons of secondary literature in continental philosophy in general. I think ultimately continental, it's all rooted in Hegel.
And I don't want to just jump in here and talk for 5 minutes. Does anybody else want to sort of give the short version of what the book as a whole is trying to do as opposed to what the chapter that we're actually going to care about is?
No, but I do want to make a request that we be very deliberate about walking through this and at least try to get through the steps of what he is trying to accomplish in the section we're in before we dive off into the deep end of all the significance and all that, because this is a tough one.
A brief statement of what the overall goal of the book is, though, would be good.
I think that the book, it is epistemology, it's theory of knowledge. I think he's a realist about knowledge. He wants to say that we know the world against Kant and the idea that there's a thing in itself we'll never know. He wants to show that epistemology is connected to the ethical and the social.
Which I can't help but point out is totally stolen from Fichte, man. Folks who have been listening to our other episodes, the Schopenhauer is sort of the closest in time and place to this. And starting at the same point in terms of post-Kantianism, and Fichte was already out there, this Kantian student who had made the practical turn, right? Who took Kant's ethics in particular and said, we are not primarily thinking beings, we are primarily acting beings. And from what I learned, I also read a few chapters from In the Spirit of Hegel by Robert C. Solomon, who we have talked about on this podcast a few times before because he taught at UT, taught Seth and Wes and myself all directly. And in fact, I did a whole independent study for a semester where I was supposedly just reading Hegel's Phenomenology and this In the Spirit of Hegel. And Solomon was big on this chapter in particular, self-consciousness, as encapsulating the Fichtean turn, at least in its initial steps. Although the most famous part, this master-slave conflict, is really Hegel's own, which he writes about not only in this book, but in virtually everything else that he wrote at the time. The rest of this book, apparently, it was written pretty fast. He expressed a lot of dissatisfaction about it later. This was really early in Hegel's career. It really gives a different side of him, this more historicist, more relativist side than the kind of Hegel, this absolutist that Kierkegaard and Schopenhauer that we've read were so critical of.
It really strikes me that he's writing this book for himself, that he was trying to work out the whole history of philosophy to his own understanding. And in part, that's why the book is so hard to read. Whereas his later work, he realizes that, my God, nobody else is going to understand. And he tries to make it more comprehensible. There's an anecdote that he gave a copy of The Phenomenology of Spirit to Goethe. And Goethe basically told him, I can't make any sense of this.
Do you know that Hegel actually edited a newspaper for a while?
And he changed all the language to make it read just like this.
No, he was actually a very capable writer. His earlier essays are actually very clear, and he didn't start writing like this until he was trying to get a permanent academic post, and he was just basically meeting the expectations of academia of the time.
Right, Fichte and Schelling also are accused of being obscurantists in the same era, yep.
But with Hegel, there's proof that he can write in a different way, about philosophy and about the news, apparently, or at least edit.
This may be rooted in Kant as well, because Kant started writing in this kind of transcendental style where there's no personal voice, where it's this trying to describe things in this ultra-abstract way.
Yeah, although I think the style is very different from Kant, because I think Hegel's really going for a level of abstraction to the point where it's... But I think you're right. He's trying to be very abstract. Where he might be more specific or give examples, he's trying to be very general. And so, you know, your fight, for instance, over whether or not to interpret it historically or in some other way, well, really all those interpretations apply, right? And that's one of the reasons why he's being so general. He wants to capture all those different senses. So I respect part of the motivation that leads to the obscurity, but I also think that, you know, at least according to Solomon's account in the Spirit of Hegel, there was actual pressure to write in a certain way to be accepted as an academic.
I'll defend Hegel the same way I defended Heidegger in saying that when you're trying to articulate something that hasn't been articulated before, and there's an accepted vocabulary that you're trying to overcome, it might require a little extra work. There's definitely a fair amount of repetitiveness, right, where he's saying the same thing over and over again in slightly different ways to try to make a point. But then you have these turns of phrase that are difficult to grasp. I imagine I didn't have time to look it up in German to look at it beforehand, but, you know, where you say the thing in itself for itself, or the for itself in itself, and this apparent duplication that maybe doesn't necessarily add anything for us, but was intended to add something.
Or it's grasped the notion, but, you know, has not grasped the reality of the situation or something like that.
Yeah.
Just these basic terms, like he's using them very repetitively, but if you don't understand the basic terms,
yeah,
then it's just a puzzle.
It is. It's like a code, and it's actually tremendously rewarding to decode Hegel. But again, as the secondary literature shows, you know, there are a lot of brilliant commentators who have given very, at the same time, they show the genius of the Hegel's account, but they also show there are clear ways to put all of this stuff. No.
Yeah, well, to actually evaluate it, you have to translate it into something else.
Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, to the extent that I can actually say, oh, yeah, I agree with Hegel on his account of the self or something, it's because somebody else has explained it to me in a simpler way, and I can evaluate that. Whereas when I actually look back at the text, like, oh, I'm not entirely sure that that's what's being said. You know, so it's strange and rewarding and frustrating.
I think with Hegel, you also get a lot of things that come in Heidegger, which is this hermeneutic turn. Like, Hegel accepts that we have to make sense of the world in the language we use. And it's obscured from us in the text, but other people have noted that Hegel actually is not extremely formal. He plays with words in order to inflect the ordinary, everyday understanding of them. I'll give you an example. He talks about content. When he's talking about consciousness or cognition in a certain stage, he'll talk about it having an idea, but the idea doesn't have content. There's a formal sense of concepts having content in formal philosophy, and then there's the sense of not having content in the sense of having fulfilled desire, not feeling contentful, just bringing it down to everyday experience and feeling. And it's there in the text, even though it's hard to see. There's definitely a sense of informality underneath.
That's an interesting point. The famous peach-colored translation by Miller, with the foreword by Findlay, that I picked up at Borders as they're going out of business and mentioned in a blog post recently. Findlay's foreword is actually quite good. And he says, Tom, the same thing, that Hegel was very self-consciously aware that he was kind of speaking from within the paradigm, but trying to talk through something, and that he was very comfortable with the idea that he was going to basically be saying things that sort of in a Wittgensteinian concept would have to be thrown away later, but that you kind of had to work from within the paradigm and the language that he had. And Mark, one of the things that you mentioned in the notice on the blog about what we were going to read, that this was Hegel's version of the state of nature.
Right.
That was an interesting point that I guess underscores the interpretive stance that you take with respect to the text. If you read this as trying to describe some sort of developmental, this is the way human beings develop consciousness or self-awareness, right, or self-consciousness, or these are the phases in history in which consciousness, I think that would be pretty restrictive, and I think it would not do justice to what he's trying to accomplish.
This comes back to the whole point about his writing style, the abstraction. In a literary sense, Hegel self-consciously was trying to refer to many, many things with this, and certainly Hobbes is there.
Without using anyone's name.
Yeah.
That's what you have to read the secondary sources that, you know, Solomon said, oh, in some of these parts, if he's especially obscure, it probably means he's parroting word for word somebody else's argument. Like that the first couple chapters are Plato from the Theaetetus and Aristotle. And then the part we are focusing on is Fichte. And the part after that is Schelling and etc.
That would be very fair. You know, Kojève, one of the very important interpreters, he calls the book a Platonic dialogue between all the philosophical systems of history. And what Kojève wants to say is that Hegel does not have his own philosophy. And it's an interesting point because as the first phenomenologist, Hegel's not putting forth his own propositions. He's simply trying to show the dialectic of history.
Well, he's taking all those moments and synthesizing them, right? Those all belong to the ultimate position or the absolute.
Which is his.
Right.
But Hegel is the end of philosophy.
Thank God that wasn't true.
Should we say, what is the book doing over? We're going to be jumping in, not midway, but a tenth of the way in.
Midway into the good part.
Yeah. What is the overall goal of the book? What is Hegel trying to do? I mean, on the one hand, he's doing something very similar to Kant by trying to ground the possibility of knowledge, let's say.
Yes.
I would say he assumes right in the intro that the possibility of knowledge does not need arguing for. That right in the introduction of the book, he says that skeptics, by which he's including even folks like Kant, who say that, oh, there's a thing in itself that we can never know, that they're unwarranted in doing that.
Well, let's not say it's an argument, but he shows how he gives this unfolding of different stages of knowledge.
I agree with you. He leads off talking a lot about science and the question of whether or not cognition or understanding can get us knowledge. I think that's part of the concern.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the important things to point out here, in a way, he's reacting to Kant's critique. A lot of the stuff, you can see it as a direct response to many things in Kant and other respondents to Kant, like Fichte. Kant spells out this close relationship between the unity of the self and the unity of experience, the way we construct the world and organize our experience as objects. And one of the things Kant ends up doing with his critique is he limits our knowledge. He cuts us off from things in themselves in order to preserve objectivity. Kant thinks that if you try and maintain our access to things in themselves, you'll never achieve objectivity for reasons that Hume spells out with regard to causality that we've talked about on this podcast. So Kant cuts us off from things in themselves in order to give us one version of knowledge, this objectivity, where objects are no longer things in themselves. And I think Hegel wants to show that, in fact, we don't need to cut ourselves off in that way.
I think Kant also wants to preserve the eternal in the thing in itself. The difference between the knowable and the unknowable in Kant is really grounded in the difference between the temporal and the atemporal. Kant wants there still to be this transcendent world of metaphysics. Hegel is like, that's the problem. We have to get rid of the idea that there's this eternal presence that's hidden from us. If we go radically temporal, we can get rid of the thing in itself.
Yeah, getting rid of the thing in itself is another way of saying that we have access after all, or that the fact that substance turns out to be subjectivity isn't going to be a problem. Anyway, Mark and Seth are going to get very angry at me if this turns into a conversation about Kant.
Wait. Yeah, we got to step in.
This actually is relevant. Hegel does distinguish, and this is more chapter 5, the one right after we stopped, but this is relevant to his style throughout, right? Because if you read this, I mean, it sounds like what we've said so far is, you know, Hegel puts forth a series of theories. First, he puts forward something like the naive theory of knowledge and shows why that's wrong. And then puts forth something like Plato's theory of knowledge, shows why that's wrong. Then Aristotle's, that's wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And he leaves out the names. But that doesn't actually capture the style here, because the style here is phenomenological, which sounds strange because phenomenology is a description of experience, but it's not our experience. If you're a Husserl, you kind of start like Descartes. I'm sitting in my chair and now I'm going to introspect on my experience, and I start talking about the things in front of me. And like, there's none of that set up for Hegel. Hegel jumps right in such that you're not even clear. Is he actually talking about a human being experience something? Or is this some kind of abstraction? Is this like how an animal experiences, or just this abstract point of view? Like, let's take a really simple theory of knowledge that's in fact too simple. Nobody actually thinks this way, but let's put ourselves in that position and analyze it. And the reason he can do that is because he's got this distinction that comes up again between really chapter 3, A Force in the Understanding, is where he talks about Kant's points about the understanding that we talked about in the Schopenhauer episode as well, about how you need concepts in order to understand anything. We use the understanding as a faculty to organize the contents of experience, something like that. But then the thing that was Schelling's contribution here, which he gets more explicit about in chapter 5, but is also there right at the beginning of the self-consciousness, is, and we talked about something like this in the Schopenhauer episode too. Schopenhauer had this, with the understanding, you can do natural science. You could sort of do the kind of things, you could track regularities, you could do causality. But to understand, remember for Schopenhauer, how everything is in fact will, like there's some faculty beyond understanding that can give us, Schopenhauer doesn't want to call it knowledge, but he ends up treating it like knowledge really through the rest of his The World is Will and Representation. Certainly something he can talk about. And it's some kind of empathy. And that's the Schelling's philosophy of nature here. It was in the air, and Hegel is playing on this, that to think of all natural forces, remember for Schopenhauer, even gravity is something that you could conceive of as will. Well, Hegel doesn't use that word exactly, but certainly as something that you could put yourself in the point of view of and describe how things would be like, which seems like a weird sort of abstraction. Like, what justifies him in being able to do that? He's got this whole big thing at the beginning, how you can't really specify a method in advance for philosophy. If you do that, you're already lost. But yet he's doing this very weird specific thing of like throwing himself from the point of view of these various things. And again, doing it very abstractly so that like in this master and slave chapter that we're going to talk about, you know, most people interpret that as two self-consciousnesses encountering each other. But there are other interpreters that think this is all going on in one person's mind.
Well, it is both.
Part of the point. Yeah, exactly. One self-consciousness is necessarily two self-consciousnesses.
Yes, absolutely.
How do we want to do this? Do you want to start at 166 and start? Because I think Seth is right. This might be one where we should really work through.
So I read through the consciousness section, and I think if we could just give like the 2-minute elevator pitch that gets you from sensation through perception to understanding, it would help.
Sure.
So this is the down home cooking version of Hegel. I love the maneuver that he does. He says, okay, well, if we're going to look for knowledge, where could it be? And one place you could say that it is sense certainty, that our sensation, like visual, auditory, tactile of the world, at least the fact of the sensation can't be denied. And you could say there's a certain immediacy to the sensation. But he says the immediacy isn't really the truth. It's not really the object, if you will, or the being. He used the term being and truth interchangeably, and I'd like some help with that at some point. But the immediacy of the experience, which is purported to give you a sound basis for knowledge, isn't really what you think it is. Because he says, suppose you say, now is night. In 12 hours, that will not be true. And you're really saying it from your perspective. And so what he does is kind of flip it around and say, anything you ascribe to sense certainty or sensation is really reflected back in you. And it's really about you.
Yeah, the critical thing there is that it, insofar as it's related to you, it means it's really a universal. So you really haven't gotten at a particular by, say, ostension and saying, here, you know, you might think there's some radical particularity there, but that here turns out to be a universal, which is illustrated by the fact that it doesn't really name anything except in the, you know, your relation using it, but then I could use it and my here would be different than your here's. So the attempt at getting at a particular breaks down and mm-hmm. you end up with something universal, which in this pattern is going to be repeated as we go forward.
And the breaking down is really key because there's you get negativity. And the negative is a really key concept for understanding Hegel. And it's a really strange concept. You know, when he's describing that now, how the now develops in sense certainty, he talks about how, you know, we apply now to this moment and then the word has a meaning for us. When the reference changes, when it's daytime and now is day, the meaning that it had for us is negated. And we have to expand the meaning to encompass this difference. The night limits the day. We understand them through contrast, but we learn that we can expand the meaning of the term now to encompass differences. So universality is a negative in Hegel. It is nothing but the differences. It's a weird way of putting it, but that's key.
One way of looking at that is that when something requires reference to something else, it's limited by that. And so once you get the possibility of the limitation of, say, here by context and you have that negation, that's sort of the same process as making it into a universal. The particular, in a way, is negated in the universal insofar as you bring into the picture lots of different particulars. And it's that assertion that you were making about the particular turns out to, in fact, involve a lot of other different particulars. And that's the limiting factor. And that's the negating factor that's associated with universality.
Yeah. If anybody wants to, I've got, I think it was section 90, or I don't know how the pagination works, but
just two sections.
Well, in that section on sense certainty, it's page 58 of the version I have. And then it's like 90 from the original section 90.
I think those are the paragraphs in Miller.
He says, when you say now is night, and then 12 hours later, now is preserved, but it's not preserved as night. That's the negation. And he says, what you find out is that it's mediated both by what it is and what it is not. Mm. And that's what it means to be a universal. And that's how that negation is critical to universality, but also ultimately is going to be critical to... You're right, Tom. He really uses this as a central, I don't know if it's the right way to call it, methodological or systemic, a structural piece of what he's doing. But the idea that negation is part of what we do and that you negate and leave behind, you negate as part of your positive
yes.
process.
He says over and over again throughout the text that cognition pays no attention to its act of differentiating. So it takes everything as a positive entity and it doesn't recognize the differentiation and difference as the active component of the concept, conceiving anything.
We need some examples here. This is going to be nothing to people. So like Bertrand Russell, let's just say a particular for him is like red patch here now. You know, so whatever that is, I'm not even going to conceptualize about it. I could be wrong about what this, you know, I think it's a book, but let's leave aside its bookness. I could be wrong about that, but I am certain right now that I am having a sensation of red. And the fact that later I'm going to have a sensation of something else, how is that even relevant to the fact that I am absolutely certain that right now I'm having a sensation of red and therefore I've founded knowledge?
Seth, you know, you said before about the difference between being and truth in Hegel. He says that in the experience of sense, the truth vanishes. And I think what he means there is that the truth is the concept of what it is. So that the concept of the book, the concept of its redness are completely necessary to having that experience of the book. So if Russell were to simply say, no, it's just this book and it's just this redness, he's just wrong. He's missing the fact that the concept, it's mediated by language. You can't make sense of a book or redness without language.
So think of Kant saying that concepts and particulars are mutually dependent, or perception is theory laden. You don't get particulars without universals. You can't access them except through concepts. They're empty. What is it? What's Kant's thing?
Intuitions without concepts are blind.
Yeah.
That's very fitting because that's almost what Hegel means when he talks about the truth disappearing.
Yeah. So, yeah, Mark, my response to what you were saying about Russell saying that particulars, red patch here now, that Hegel says in this section that what sensation gives you or what sense certainty is immediacy. But it's an immediacy that he says does not have the truth of being. It has the truth of has been. And so in addition to the fact that the immediacy of sensation doesn't give you a particular, it just gives you the immediacy of this broad swath. You may talk about it and say, oh, now is night, I am here now. And you think you're talking about a particular that points something out, but in reality, you're just making reference to universals. He also seems to think that sensation is always talking about something that's past, which is to say you're talking about something that is not, and that knowledge is not about what is not, it's about what is.
There's also the social dimension here. These are valid.
Not in this chapter.
No, I think it is present. It's just that it doesn't become apparent until later and you look back, because there's no way that the universal makes sense if it isn't part of language, and language already implies a social dimension.
I don't know. What do you guys think about this as a criticism, though, of a theory that says that our sense data are going to be the source of our enduring eternal knowledge? I think the points he made were pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it seems, again, the idea that, say, perception is theory-laden, or if you analyze the concept of radical particularity that fools itself into thinking it's escaped universality, you'll find that the universal is already there. The concept is already there, or whatever, however you want to put it. I think that's the point he's making, and
I think that's good enough for one-third of our two-minute summary.
I agree.
And the second part is, once you've admitted that universals are involved in you seeing things, well, there's still the problem of the relation of properties to their underlying substance, something like that. That's what the second one is about.
So we went from sense certainty to perception. And basically, perception is the layer at which you start to make distinctions in your sensation and identify things with properties, as opposed to just straight up sense certainty.
And he's going to say the concept of a thing is ultimately incoherent, because just like back to Descartes' wax example,
exactly.
Where, oh, look, the wax, it can melt away, it can change all these properties, but yet it's still the wax. Therefore, what the wax really is the underlying substance that has all these properties. But then, well, what is that? That's a completely empty concept. So we sort of go back and forth between thinking of this mysterious, unknowable substance that underlies all these properties and, oh, a cluster of properties, which that just doesn't even make sense because there has to be something that holds them together as the thing. And so both of these are unsatisfactory. So we have to get pushed to the next level.
Yep.
I felt like this was a little more nuanced than that. I thought what he was saying was, look, if you get to the level of perception and you identify a thing with properties, the thing in itself or the thing being for itself, you think of it as differentiated from everything else, except that as soon as you use the word differentiation, you have to compare it to something else. You have this thing, it has properties, but you can abstract out the properties. And then you can say, oh, well, it has this property, but not this property. And these properties are contradictory. And this thing has these other properties, and it's not this thing. And so this idea that there's a thing that exists in itself that you're somehow discerning with perception, it breaks down because you have to negate that standaloneness. This is where he says, you know, you have to acknowledge the also. The also is the relationship to other things into this whole unified group.
Or is it the relation of the properties within the thing? The fact that the wax has a color and the wax has a texture.
The example he uses is salt. He says, you can say, oh, here's a container of salt. And we might say, oh, that's the thing. The thing is this container of salt, and it has the property of whiteness, and it has the property of being tart, being salty, I guess. I don't know. And he says, but actually, the saltiness and the whiteness and all that are in me, and they can be in other things as well. But we use other properties to distinguish that from the pepper shaker, for example. Just the idea that you would pick out an individual thing with the faculty of perception and call it a thing in itself and standalone doesn't make sense for two reasons. One is it's always in relation to other things. And the other thing is it is always a thing for you or for consciousness. He uses the term consciousness. Mm-hmm. So there's no such thing as a thing in itself. There's a thing in itself for consciousness.
But we also wouldn't want to infer then that that means that the things are just pure ideas. This is total idealism in the sense that the reality just has this subjective character.
No. What he's saying is at the level of perception, if you're talking about a thing, you're not talking about the thing in itself. You're talking about the thing as it is in your perception.
Right. That's the phenomenology. Yep.
Yes, because your perception, you're already contributing the universal and the concepts and all that stuff to it to make it into a thing. He mentions very early on that we think of cognition as either an instrument that shapes things for knowledge or a medium through which they get distorted. And if we could just figure out how the instrument affects it or figure out how the medium distorts it, we'd be able to get at the things themselves. And this is kind of the key move for me where he's saying perception, and ultimately we're going to find out that understanding as well, is not a medium or an instrument. It's not like you can remove the filter or correct for the changes that the instrument of perception makes. It's that everything is always for perception, for consciousness.
In a weird way, I think all these moments, sense certainty, perception, the phenomenology both shows their failure, but it also validates them. The idea of the phenomenology is that you're showing how it is that cognition comes to these concepts. The invalidation or the failure is also in desire, and that this is what will lead up to self-consciousness.
Which, so you just pushed us to the third part, force
right.
And the understanding.
Just for the listeners out there, this one is brutal. This is,
but we are going to be similarly brief with it.
Yes, I agree, but it was still it's extremely tough reading.
Someone give it one line.
The key thing here is, and we can maybe shoot ahead a little bit and anticipate the self-consciousness chapter. The concept of force for Hegel is where the concept of dialectic is really introduced. One of Hegel's arguments in Force and Understanding is that we can't conceive force without a relation. Force inherently means expression. So a force has to be expressed. And to be expressed, it has to be expressed into something that limits it. So force forces us to have a concept of multiple forces. You have to have something exerting force and something resisting in order for that force to meet, like a presence. And so there you have this kind of dialectical character of the concept of force.
I think we need to give an example with every single one of these, or it's just not. So, for instance, it's this thinking about gravity. Like, really, all we know gravity is because things are falling. So you could say, look at all those things falling. That is gravity. The thing falling is gravity. Or you could imagine that there's something behind it pushing the thing. There's that invisible force that's causing it. So are those the two moments of the force? Is the actual phenomena experienced and then this thing we posit as being behind it? I wasn't really sure what the duality. That doesn't translate into, oh, there have to be two forces there.
If a force is an activity, there has to be a reactive resistance to it.
There really is a strong parallel to Kant here. And with part C and the understanding and the concept of force, right? I mean, it's reminiscent, for instance, of Hume's critique of causality. In a way, I think it's a restatement of that. So the idea is that, you know, we don't take in something like causality through our senses. And when something like that is an object for us, there's a sense in which we're making ourselves an object. It's the form of our experience. In a way, our access to that is really an access to ourselves. It sort of leads into the next stage of self-consciousness. Experience is being constructed by the understanding. And in accessing those, we're not accessing something which is itself a phenomena. We're accessing something which is formal. And that formal element has been added by the subject. So insofar as we're accessing that formal element, we're accessing subjectivity. So we're on our way to self-consciousness.
Yeah, he talks about the supersensible, that this is where we first get an explicit idea of something that is a not directly empirical object of sense. To conceive of a force means that we have to begin thinking beyond the immediate objects of sense.
Yeah.
We talked about something similar to this. I don't remember which episode it was, where we were talking about this idea of an inner life and whether you could actually stop thinking. Like, you can't prevent yourself from having idea after idea. You know, you can't stop your mind from doing what it does. Hegel says at one point in this section, he talks about the simple inner world. He's got a nice sort of summary at the beginning of the section 4 where he says, in the previous modes of certainty, what is true for consciousness is something other than itself. But the notion of this truth vanishes in the experience of it. What the object immediately was in itself, mere being in sense certainty, the concrete thing of perception, and for the understanding a force, proves to be in truth not this at all. Instead, this in itself turns out to be a mode in which the object is only for another. If we think about these three stages that we're about to leave behind, in each one we identify something that's supposed to be the object of knowledge that turns out to be really for something else. So in sense certainty, it's being, which turns out to be for consciousness via universals. Perception, it's the thing in itself, which turns out to be for consciousness via universals. And then understanding is a bit more complicated because you have sort of this inner world or this force that still ultimately has to refer to some sort of perception or refer to something outside of itself to have any kind of content. To kind of try to use non-Hegelian language to close out this section to Marx's satisfaction, what he's saying is, if you go looking in these three places for objects of knowledge that you can rely on in some way, shape, or form, sense, perception, or understanding, you end up having to refer to something else in order for them to have any meaning or to make sense, to have content. And so they're not suitable objects for knowledge.
Sure. Let me put one more thing out from Solomon about the movement from this forcing the understanding part to the part that we're actually going to focus on, which is self-consciousness. So we're talking about in chapter 3 there, forcing the understanding about science, right? We've got forces, we've got causality more generally. I don't know if Hegel actually says something like this in the text. I didn't look closely enough, but Solomon brought up that image that we talked about in our Wittgenstein Tractatus episode. You know, you've got all these phenomena that science records, and then you have a theoretical structure on top of it. You could even think of it as like you've got a bunch of dots, and you could draw different shapes on top of it, and the shapes could still give you a good picture of the dots. It's just, you know, a number of different shapes would do it. So that ultimately, science is not going to definitively tell you for any given set of phenomena what theoretical structure to have over that. So you have to choose between them. You have to turn to some sort of pragmatic consideration. You have to turn, why are we doing the science in the first place? What kind of explanation do we want out of it? So for instance, to our philosophy of mind episode, I'm looking at human behavior. I could try to just explain it in terms of behavioral inputs and outputs. I could try to explain it on a neural level. I could try to explain it just in terms of your conscious experience, you know, something phenomenologically. And our choice between those is not only going to be sort of how accurately does it match the variety of data and does it let us predict certain things, Well, actually, prediction is very much on par here, because that plays into, well, why are we doing this theorization in the first place? If I'm trying to determine, for instance, I'm trying to construct a workplace that is going to, you know, make my workers have maximum output, then maybe a behaviorist model will work pretty well. I don't have to pay attention to what they say about whether they like it or not. I just have to pay attention to, if I turn the lights up, do they work better? If I turn the temperature down, do they work better? A behaviorist model works just fine for that. There's a turn in all epistemological practice to the pragmatic.
One important thing here, Mark, I think, just to give a overview of these three parts that we've talked about, you know, we started out with sense certainty, and increasingly the contributions of the subject become increasingly important, right? So the idea is that we have yet another contribution from the subject with which we're headed towards self-consciousness. It's sort of a mirror for the subject. I mean, ultimately, the contribution of the subject will become work, where we're actually crafting the world to reflect us.
Seth, you know German?
Yeah.
What is craft?
Craft is strength.
Okay.
Craft work is a 80s.
That's what that section is called. Kraft und Verstand. Force and understanding.
Etymologically, it sounds like, you know, we're moving into this idea that we understand force because of our own agency, our own craft.
All right.
Self-consciousness.
Okay.
Just summarizing 166. So he says, in what's come before, we've seen that there's successive attempts at getting at some sense of a independent thing in itself for knowledge, kept turning into a, quote, mode in which the object is only for another. So again, the contributions of the subject kept getting more, you know, with every step, the for another part kept coming back in. We gave up. This is where I think he's reiterating the Kantian theme of giving up certainty for truth, which means, I think, giving up things in themselves for objectivity. Consciousness takes itself as an object, but now we get to the point where consciousness will take itself as an object, which means that certainty and objectivity become the same thing. The being in itself and the being for another are the same. Because I take my I by taking myself as an object, it's something which has this immediacy for me.
Right. We should point out for listeners, so you're probably used to hearing the word objectivity as meaning that's sort of mind independent. Oh, that's objective. But
yeah, good point.
For a phenomenologist, right, if the mind is focused on something, then it is the mind's object, and therefore it is objective.
So to say objectivity means, yeah, we've given up things in themselves, or objectivity means we've restricted ourselves to the realm of phenomena. And objectivity is made possible because our mind constructs phenomena, and then when we come back to it to make judgments, we can make the concepts accord properly with what we're judging. So the phenomena are these subject-laden objects, and that's how we get objectivity. But we've given up a sort of naive notion of access to things in themselves in order to ground that objectivity. So now we get to the important part of this, is this idea that when we take ourselves as an object, we're now in this special position.
You could say also that this is sort of the Cartesian moment, and this is like Descartes saying that, aha, the cogito is the basis of all knowledge because it's so certain. But what Hegel wants to say is, okay, great, but this is just an abstraction because we haven't yet understood how that's possible or why we've arrived at that point. We're just saying, yes, Descartes, he's got it. He's like, yes, you know, the I is this certainty. But in Hegel's language, every phase of consciousness passes through at least three stages. An early stage, which he calls the immediate. There's a middle stage where we find there are problems. We find we don't fully understand this immediate idea that we had. And it comes into discord with the rest of our experience because it's still not adequate to describe or to comprehend the rest of our experience. And then like a late stage where it just falls apart and then a new idea kind of emerges. Right now, we're just at this immediate grasp of self.
And so in 167, we get a problem.
This seems like a good time, just the way you were describing that, Tom. So remember, Schopenhauer's big beef with this was that Hegel, and a lot of other philosophers, he think, did not properly distinguish between the relationships between ideas and relationships between physical things. That, according to Schopenhauer, the principle of sufficient reason needs to be clearly differentiated in different realms so that we don't confuse, say, the laws of causality with the way logical deductions work, that we really need to keep those to their proper realms. And Hegel is entirely, I mean, you were just describing it, Tom, in terms of ideas, which sounds like the earlier chapters that we're talking about. We got this idea of this theory of sense certainty, and we examine it, and it ends up falling apart by the end of the section. But in this section, we're going to be actually talking about beings themselves. We're going to be actually talking about organisms who are looking at themselves, and maybe the organism itself is changing. So we're saying, just like ideas have these changes, the objects themselves have this change. And I can put that sort of to the highest level of abstraction. We've talked a few times about Heraclitus versus Parmenides, the idea of Parmenides. Oh, everything is static. Ultimately, underneath all this apparent change, there's just a static oneness or something like that. And Heraclitus, oh, no, 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 everything is ultimately flux. So Hegel's contribution is, as you probably guessed, he's a version of Heraclitus, of everything is change, but it's a very specific pattern of change. It's more like, think of it theologically, God as a singularity. If you want to say there's this entity that is everything, well, at the same time, it is nothing. Because for it to be a particular thing, it has to contrast with something else. For there to be anything at all, there has to be a disruption, a break. And then so you've got part of existence confronted by another part. We've got some sort of division that's been made. And that's sort of where consciousness, interpreted in an extremely broad, almost metaphorical sense, I would say, comes from. The fact that whenever you have a difference between two things, you could then adopt a point of view of one of the things sort of looking at the other. And it's only defined as a thing in relation to the fact that there's another thing out there. That brings about this recognition of negativity, that even if, as you recognize yourself, I am this thing, you are positing that there is an other. So in other words, there's a negativity in me. I'm not this other thing. So you could take that on any level. You could talk about God. You could talk about natural phenomena. You could, you know, so this is the cycle of life itself. So that's how the dialectic, let's just call this the dialectic, even though apparently that's not a term. Certainly the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, those are actually Fichtean terms, and Hegel doesn't really use them. But since they're more popularly associated with him. And again, the part of the reason that doesn't work as well, because that sounds like it's applying to theories, right? Here's my thesis that I'm arguing for. Here's the antithesis, another theory. Here's a synthesis that combines those. But he's also talking about the progression of beings.
You know, what's interesting about that dialectical character of I am not this other thing is that that's not apparent at first. That's the way that self-consciousness doesn't recognize its own act of distinction. We just think it's given.
Exactly, and that's 167, right? We sort of get a thin gruel of ourselves in the beginning, right, in 166. That immediate access to ourselves turns out to be this tautologous identity. You know, I thought here of Frege, because I thought of the A equals A versus, say, the morning star is the evening star, which is an informative identity. Mm-hmm. So Hegel saying in 167, you know, this immediate access identity that we have is mere tautology, which is right, A equals A. And what we're after is something that's actually, which is actually something that's meaningful. To be meaty and real, as opposed to this thin and empty access to ourselves, we have to be able to take something as properly other. And that's where you get desire directed towards the other. There's an emptiness that we have in this tautologous identity that just is desire. The desire for the other that we need in order to get the more substantial access to ourselves.
Is the desire quote here in 167, or is that later?
I'm just paraphrasing 167. Yeah, that's all there.
Let's read the part.
Around the middle, I guess, he says, "But in point of fact, self-consciousness is a reflection out of the being of the world, of sense and perception, and is essentially a return from otherness. As self-consciousness, it is movement, but since what it distinguishes from itself is only itself as itself, the difference, as an otherness, is immediately superseded for it. The difference is not, and it, self-consciousness, is only the motionless tautology of I am I. But since for it the difference does not have the form of being, it is not self-consciousness." Here he's talking about the problem with 167, where the immediate access is tautology. And if you go down further, you get the talk of the desire that that sense of emptiness creates.
Well, let's talk phenomenologically for a second, that you can have this point of view toward yourself that it's like you are just a mere point. If you just focus on your minute-to-minute experience, don't think of yourself as a human being or as, you know, having a particular name and being in a particular situation, but just as the pure spectator of the stream of consciousness. It's like the you in there is something that you can disassociate with anything. Even yeah. your own thoughts, you could feel like, oh, aliens are injecting these thoughts into me or something. Or this body is not my body. Maybe you're really sick. And so you disassociate yourself. You're in a lot of pain. You disassociate yourself from your pain. The fact that you have the ability to do that, that means that the point of consciousness is completely empty in itself. That for there to be a substantial self, you have to make up a self-image.
Right. So what he's critiquing is this, I would say, Cartesian or transcendental ego, where being an I, I think he mentions in 166, you know, the I is this sort of supervenes on this identity relationship, which will turn out to be tautologous. I think another way of looking at that is, you know, the I described by Descartes or Kant, it's just this empty assignation which says this set of experiences belongs to the same domain. I'm having this experience, and then I'm having this experience, and all those are synthetically held together in the same consciousness. But there's nothing to differentiate that I from any other I. Those sets of experiences may differ, but the I itself is just a complete and impersonal abstraction. And I think that's the problem that Hegel's pointing to here.
It's absolutely.
It's not real for us, and there's an emptiness to it.
I mean, what did you think about this throwing in desire here? Let me just read that part of the quote.
Okay.
Hence, otherness is for it in the form of a being or as a distinct moment, but there is also for consciousness the unity of itself with this difference as a second distinct moment. With this first moment, self-consciousness is in the form of consciousness, and the whole expanse of the sensuous world is preserved for it, but at the same time, only as connected with the second moment, the unity of self-consciousness with itself, and hence the sensuous world is for it an enduring existence, which, however, is only appearance, or a difference which, in itself, is no difference. I'm still not to the desire part, and I'm totally freaking lost. Do we want to decode that part so far?
You mean where he says that self-consciousness is desire itself?
That's the next sentence.
Okay, so this part that you've just described, Mark, yeah. when Kant gets rid of our, and I think he is thinking specifically about him and Fichte without referring directly to him, but when you get rid of things in themselves, and you say, okay, now we only have access to these appearances, which to some extent we've constructed. And so for Kant, that grounds I, right? The unity of objects. So that's sort of the seed of what Hegel's going to elaborate on here. It's a unity or experience that grounds our I-ness. But for Hegel, I think he's saying here, that's not enough. The appearance is sort of a thin thing. Because it's only appearance for us and we've constructed it, it doesn't provide enough otherness to provide that difference which will demarcate an I for us that's real.
So if things are only appearances, if we've sort of taken a Fichtean position or some kind of idealist position where my whole experience world is a part of me in some sense. But we had the Husserl episode where he describes something like that, where everything is based around the transcendental ego and these are all part of my world. Yep. That's not going to be enough to get me a sense of self.
Yeah. So remember in Sense Certainty, when we thought we could have these objects which were completely other and set that up in opposition to ourselves, and that didn't work. Well, at this point where we just have these appearances, which has already sort of been drawn into the self, well, that's no longer other enough to give us any robust sense of I.
The objects that we've considered in the previous chapters are just the objects of nature, sensuous things. This is a phenomenology of spirit, and Hegel is ultimately trying to say that this is just not satisfactory to us. It doesn't tell us what we are. So that's part of the need to move from the previous forms of consciousness. Mm-hmm. There's a cool quote. It's going back a little bit, but he talks about the sort of irrelevance of the sensuous objects in a passage from Sense Certainty.
Is this about the animals eating things up?
Yes, he says, even the animals are not shut out from this wisdom, but on the contrary, show themselves to be most profoundly initiated into it. For they do not just stand idly in front of sensuous things as if these possessed intrinsic being, but despairing of their reality and completely assured of their nothingness, they fall due without ceremony and eat them up.
Yeah, that's a great one.
And all nature, like the animals, celebrates these open mysteries which teach the truth about sensuous things. There's this critique of presence here, too. The idea of fetishizing objects. The self is going to be something that isn't a static thing, that it's moving and it's desire and it's spiritual.
All right, so the next sentence then. This antithesis of appearance and its truth, which we've just described, has, however, for its essence only the truth. Namely, the unity of self-consciousness with itself. This unity must become essential to self-consciousness, i.e. self-consciousness is desire in general. So this unity must become essential to self-consciousness. I'm interpreting that as it must have some sort of substance to it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It must become a morning star is evening star type of statement. Instead of a bare tautology, which of course will end up being you need another self-consciousness in there.
All right, Seth, we haven't heard from you in a while. What do you think about desire?
What do I think about desire? I'm in favor of it.
In this context. I mean, he's,
oh, not generally? Okay.
He's putting human motivation here in the middle of what looks like a phenomenological account of epistemology. He's putting...
Yeah, I think he's using this word. Remember when Heidegger used the word concern?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Care?
Yes.
This is, I think, a similar kind of move. So the sentence immediately after that sentence helps to clarify a little bit. So maybe we go to that and then we'll come back to it. So he says, consciousness as self-consciousness henceforth has a double object. One is the immediate object, that of sense certainty and perception, which, however, for self-consciousness has the character of a negative. And the second, vis-a-vis itself, which is the true essence and is present in the first instance only as opposed to the first object. Breaking this down, the idea where he says self-consciousness is desire in general. Self-consciousness has this two objects. There's the object that we typically think of, the traditional object of consciousness, which is what he talked about earlier on in the first three sections, right?
But what is that in the case of self-consciousness? He's saying in self-consciousness has two objects. One is the abnormal object of consciousness. So what is that?
No, in self-consciousness, there's two objects. One is going to be the typical object of perception. The other will be itself. So
yes.
Consciousness takes itself as an object, and then it takes regular objects as objects, and those are the two.
Right. The first thing he's trying to say is that when consciousness takes itself as an object, i.e. self-consciousness, what we're not talking about here is consciousness treating itself like it treats perception or sense certainty or even concepts or notions or whatever the understanding. It's the movement, the actual taking itself as an object, self-consciousness meaning consciousness taking itself as an object, that movement itself is somehow different than consciousness taking something that is not itself as an object. And then he uses the word desire. Self-consciousness is desire in general to describe that movement.
Self-consciousness is desire at this moment where its access to itself is thin and unsatisfying, right? It's the tautological access to itself that creates a sense of emptiness. What he's saying in that paragraph you just read, Seth, is that at this stage, self-consciousness is derived from, it's really a matter of contrast with consciousness of objects. It's that thin Kantian, I think, which sort of is inferred from the unity of experience. And what he's saying is that that's empty, creates a sense of movement forward, a desire to get a more substantial form of self-consciousness.
Ooh, I like that. I like that a lot.
I like that. I want to put that in terms of the double object. The first of the objects is I'm trying to look at myself, but as Hume says, you know, all I see is a particular experience that's going on at this time. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I have this thought in my head. Was the thought me? No, you know, so that's why it says it's purely a negative.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the first moment of self-consciousness. These are both trying to be pointing at self. It's just the first one doesn't find anything.
Here in this initial stage, consciousness only has access to itself as a negative in the sense of as contrasting to the field of, or it's inferred from the field of experience. This really is the Kantian or Cartesian moment. Thin, empty, and Kant even will say, no, we don't have any other access to ourselves beyond that. Hegel's going to say, that's not real self-consciousness, and there is something above and beyond that. And at this stage, this Kantian stage, I think, there's an emptiness desire to move towards the real substantial self-consciousness.
But it's interesting that there's a partial truth in Kant that Hegel is building on.
Well, none of these moments go away. It's not like any of us has gotten rid of desire. So you can read it as a temporal story. You can read it as a history of thought. You can read it as simply an elaboration of moments, which are all, they're all included in the final structure.
I have a slightly different reading of this because it's open to so many readings. I'm going to claim it's just as valid. When he says one object of consciousness is the immediate object, sense certainty and perception, when we were talking before about sense certainty and we said, you know, there's a difference between immediacy and being or immediacy and truth. If consciousness takes as its object sense certainty or perception, it's kind of referred back to itself via the universal, right? That's what we kind of established. Mm-hmm. That's the negative movement. You say, oh, well, I'm talking about this thing, but actually in order for it to make sense, I have to refer to something outside of it. And that negates it. And it says, well, wait a second. What if I'm talking about the thing to which I'm referring? So in other words, sense, certainty, perception refer back to consciousness. And then consciousness says, okay, well, I take consciousness itself as my object. What am I going to refer to outside of it? It's like, whoops. You know what? We don't have that same movement. We can't take the same move with consciousness taking itself as an object. You can't make the same move as you do when consciousness takes sense, certainty, or perception as its object, because consciousness is not going to refer to something outside of itself that is itself in the same way that sense, certainty, and perception do. Does that make sense?
I like that it uses the last sentence there, that in this sphere, self-consciousness exhibits itself as the movement in which this antithesis is removed and the identity of itself with itself becomes explicit with it. So in other words, the two objects of self-consciousness, one are what the arrow is pointing at, which is this empty self, or it's the arrow itself, the looped around arrow, the process itself, which, as you're saying, you can't actually make that an object. You can't make the arrow point at itself, but you could still, as a concept, talk about the process of knowing yourself or something.
When the thing you're trying to take as your object is the thing to which all these other objects ultimately have to make recourse in order for them to have meaning, there's kind of like a non-objectivity about it, then you're kind of lost. Self-consciousness becomes desire, the seeking, because consciousness isn't really an object in the same way these other things are objects, because it is the thing to which these other objects ultimately have to refer in order for them to have any kind of sense. And then you're suddenly like, well, wait a second, what do I do now? Right? And that kind of kicks off the whole section.
Clearly kind of established that it's this kind of empty and dissatisfactory concept of self. But then where do you guys see the move to the introduction of the other self?
Several sections later.
Yeah, we have a ways to go before that.
Is it? Because I think it's 170.
Well, 168, he's already talking about life.
Yeah.
So let's read some of that, because that's the next step toward it. Through this reflection into itself, the object has become life. What self-consciousness distinguishes from itself as having being also has in it, insofar as it is posited as being, not merely the character of sense, certainty, and perception, but it is being that is reflected into itself, and the object of immediate desire is a living thing. So what do you guys make of that so far?
This is a weird... There are a lot of tough and weird paragraphs in this book, but...
The next few sections are actually one of the hardest, I think, in the whole... So in 167, right, we had this initial non-robust sense of self-consciousness coming out as the distinction between subject and object, where object is dead inanimate objects. Objects insofar as they're simply objects. And he's saying there's a special type of object in our experience which gives us a clue to a more robust sense of self-consciousness. And it gives us that clue because it has a special biological entities. Insofar as they're biological objects and we see them as living and we recognize them in that way, they're not like objects taken as those passive objects of our experience and sense certainty, or even as the constructed appearances for Kant. They have their own independence and activity, and that's a clue to a different type of self-consciousness. I don't know if that made any sense.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And you might say that speaking from experience, if we talk about being a primitive human being or an animal on the cusp, would you have a sense of self if you didn't see these other things as self-like? Or, I see the apple, I eat the apple, I move the rock. But when you encounter something that seems to have a kind of independent agency, this actually is the condition for the possibility of you beginning to conceive of yourself as that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's as if the recognizing something as a living thing will be a precursor to recognizing the other conscious or self-conscious entity that will make the picture more complete.
And right? It would mediate your own access to the concept of yourself as that kind of agency.
Add to that, this is from Solomon, that whenever you desire something, you impute an independence to it that is kind of like life. So, if your computer is screwing up, then you start swearing at it and trying to do magic to make it work for you or get the car to start. So just anything that is an object of desire, anything that's in your way, you perceive as a living thing, even if you know that it's obviously not a living thing, but you impute it to something as if it could be cajoled. That seems a stretch, but in terms of trying to make sense of what he's getting at here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's right. But it's just that I think in that kind of example, like if I kick my car and I'm mad at it, this is conditional on already being part of a world where agency is the primary concept, that certainly there's says something about us that we think that way. But in terms of Hegel's phenomenology, I mean, he's trying to get at this kind of initial genesis of that idea. Like, how do we ever begin thinking that way, period, from the beginning? Like, what was that point where some primitive human person began to get the concept of agency? It would had to have been in some kind of primeval moment where some primitive consciousness perceived other humanoid type things and then began to develop this concept.
I guess I would say the same thing that Kant says about causality is that if you weren't equipped with it in the first place, you couldn't get it from experience. You have to impose it upon things. This is something that's built into us.
So does it have to be a priori? I don't think Hegel has a priori. I think he's trying to say that none of this is a priori. It all appears phenomenologically. It all comes on the scene through experience.
Here's another way of getting at this paragraph. Basically, I think Hegel's saying, right, there are special types of objects of experience. And you remember we got that in Schopenhauer to some extent too, where Schopenhauer wants to talk about the body. So, you know, we have access to our own body as something which is both for ourselves and an object to us. I think there's something similar going on in here where Hegel's introduction of this special type of object, which in the end, you know, what he says in the end is it's a clue. We have to get to some sort of capacity to be conscious of other consciousnesses and their self-consciousness. But on the way, there's this very important recognition of something as independent. You know, we don't get the same sense of independence from a rock that we get from a rabbit, obviously. So however that happens, a priori or not, I don't know. But I think that last sentence of this paragraph is very important. Self-consciousness, which is simply for itself and directly characterizes its object as negative, as a negative element, or is primarily desire, will therefore, on the contrary, learn through the experience that the object is independent. Biological objects are an example of a kind of independence that you don't get from the objects with which really Kant was thinking about when he was thinking about our cognition. I think this sort of mirrors Schopenhauer's emphasis on a special type of object, you know, our own bodies.
The thing I'm confused about here is that he doesn't seem to be making a distinction between different kinds of objects that fall in that category. It's just the object which for self-consciousness is the negative element. And that could be all different kinds of objects.
Those are inanimate objects. This meager self-consciousness, which is not so robust because it's only aware of itself in contradistinction to inanimate objects.
Oh, whoa, inanimate. Whoa. Wait.
So that's meager. So our first step in making this more robust is to get more robust objects, and animate objects are more robust. They're not the passive things. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
No, I do. I don't see it in the text, but I do understand what you're saying. But it sounds like up until this point, part of the movement of self-consciousness taking itself as an object is understanding the difference between there being living objects and the objects of our sense, certainty, and perception, which... Yep. Taken straight phenomenologically, are not necessarily living in the same way we think of ourselves as living.
Right.
So, in other words, the movement is we have sense certainty, we have perception, we have understanding, all of which is very what we'll call lifeless.
Yep.
And then at some point, when we turn on ourselves and we get this confused notion of ourself as consciousness, as this unity that doesn't make any sense, we suddenly get this idea of life. Or
exactly.
Desire in life somehow, which in turn we're going to then reflect back out onto the external world and start distinguishing between things which are inanimate and things which have life.
Yeah. To get past Kant, we have to learn that objects are independent of ourselves, and biology is the first step.
Okay.
This isn't necessarily totally linear and sequential. That's part of the problem, is that we're entering into part of the text that is more historical, that starts to take on this narrative structure.
It's not historical. I'll fight you.
A story. Well, you know, clearly if we start talking about masters and slaves, we're talking about more of a narrative situation. And I think that's the thing we're struggling with here. How do you make this transition? You do have to shoot ahead and say that ultimately Hegel wants to say that the first three chapters of the book really are themselves conditioned. They would not have been possible if they were not already a social situation. So we can't think of it as like consciousness doesn't have to get from there to here by itself.
No, I understand that. So call it logical, don't call it developmental, whatever you want. I'm just trying to understand what the frick he's saying here, which I have a way of reading that now. I think I understand what he's saying. So
I think you want to say Fuchsenzeit.
I was going to say Fuchsenzeit. But okay, I think I got hung up on the word unity, because it seemed like this paragraph was trying to point out that the turn taking yourself as an object kind of gives you a concept of a unity as well.
But I would say, and that is totally connected, I think he's introducing the experience of a social situation right here. In 170, he says, the self-sufficient members exist for themselves. However, this being for itself is likewise, and even more so, immediately their reflection into unity. Just as this unity is estrangement into self-sufficient shapes. So I think what this means is that this scene I would try to paint of primeval ape man encountering and just barely trying to get some cognitive sense of his others. And he understands himself as an agent through seeing other things that are like him. And so right there you have multiplicity. You would not have this concept if there weren't multiple of this kind of thing. Does that make sense?
It's difficult. I mean, I think he's talking about sexual reproduction in 170.
Okay. Well, no, listen, there's a way of reading this, I think, that the concept of the social as it's introduced here, Tom, is still somewhat limited. Although you're right, it's presupposed, I think, throughout. We don't really get into it until a couple paragraphs later.
I mean, a lot of 169, just to sum it up, is about the individual members surviving by leaving offspring.
What?
Seriously.
I think we have to read it.
Yes, there's the metaphor of the continually canceled self-otherness in rotation.
It is this very flux as a self-identical independence, which is itself an enduring existence, in which, therefore, they are present as distinct members and parts existing on their own account. These are the objects. So consciousness
is living things.
Consciousness is the enduring existence, and the objects of consciousness are these distinct members that exist.
The distinct members are like the specific rabbits.
Sure, specific rabbits or whatever. Being no longer has the significance of abstract being, nor has their pure essentiality the significance of abstract universality. On the contrary, being is precisely that simple fluid substance of pure movement within itself. The difference, however, qua difference of these members with respect to one another consists in general in no other determinateness than that of the moments of infinity or of the pure movement itself. Okay, that didn't help at all. But just like in paragraph 168, there was something about unity and life coming to bear. 169, he seems to be saying something about the experience of self-consciousness. When consciousness takes itself as an object, you get the concept of the notion of enduring existence, that persistence through time that is the unity of the self. And that the things outside of the self are differentiated, but they're all part of some continuity. In other words, consciousness is the thing that holds everything together.
Yeah.
And when consciousness looks at itself as an object, it understands for the first time that this whole manifold of individual things that are differentiated and all that stuff are held together by this one, not just any, you know, not a universal, but a particular thing, a particular essence that is itself.
But, you know, when he talks about the unity, I think he's making a claim more for us, the readers, the phenomenological observers of consciousness. He's saying that, look, the individual members gain this access to a sense of themselves as an individual agency by it seeing it at work in others. And so we grasp the unity of this situation, but consciousness doesn't necessarily grasp it for itself.
Okay. These two pages in the book, these four paragraphs here, 168 through 171, are just...
They are, and they're famous for being almost incomprehensible. My, you know, bullshit comes from a lot of commentary that I read, so it's really not fair.
But to me, they're the meat, so let me throw out this general characterization, see if we can agree on it or not. Whether we're talking phenomenologically or if this is a self-experience, like growth movement that consciousness goes through, the unity of the self, its persistence through time, and the way that it brings together perception and sense certainty into a unified whole and is able to actually create distinctions and all that stuff, and the ability to distinguish that its objects are independent of it, all of that requires that consciousness take itself as an object. If consciousness was not capable of taking itself as an object, you would have none of those things which are characteristic of what we call existence or life. Is that a fair assessment?
Sure. Just from our own experience, you have a sense of yourself. You're thinking about, what am I going to do today? What am I going to do tomorrow? In the most ordinary everyday experience, our sense of ourselves is conditioned and mediated by the context and the whole world situation that we're in. We position ourselves like, I'm going to go into work and tell my boss he's an asshole or something. Our own sense of identity to its core is related to our possibilities for relating to the world. He's just trying to say that there is no self-access or self-identity without this relationality.
See, I think he's saying, well, he might be saying that as well, but I think he's saying our experience of life, as we know it, meaning a continual flow of events that's unified and a sense of an enduring substance that is us, is the relation of consciousness to itself. All that stuff takes place as a function of consciousness taking itself as an object.
Consciousness to itself mediated by all this other stuff.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I have kind of a problem with that formulation. You have to bring in the mediation of genuine otherness. I think this radical difference of the other, the fact that the others are really there and really other agents, is what mediates the possibility for me conceiving of myself in the same way. So you can just as equally say that self-consciousness is a function of the other, as to say that the other is a function of self-consciousness.
Let's be more specific, because you just capitalized other, which we weren't talking about here. Consciousness has two objects. There's the object of consciousness that is sense certainty and perception. That's one kind of object. That's one kind of other. And then consciousness also can take itself to be an object, can take itself to be other. And what I take these four paragraphs to be doing is talking about the significance of consciousness taking itself as an other.
Yeah, and I think it's not possible to signify oneself. As a matter of fact, you know what? There's a paragraph here where he talks about significance. To shoot ahead on this point, but at 197, he says, to think does not mean to think as an abstract I, but as an I which at the same time signifies being in itself. That is, it has the meaning of being an object in its own eyes, or of conducting itself by way of the objective essence. He's criticizing Descartes here. He's saying, you can't just say, I am I, but you have to signify. You have to have gained this idea that, for instance, we're communicating right now and we're using language. And when I say I, both you guys and I myself understand that I'm referring to myself. I give significance to the fact that I am I through language. And that's what's missing in Descartes. We can't give significance to the I without a communicative situation. So that's why I think you just have to bring in the real concrete other.
Can I pull out my old Saturday Night Live reference?
Yeah.
Tom, you ignorant slut.
I have no response to that.
No, no, no. So I get your point.
I'm ready for a life and death struggle, maybe.
Are you good? I was not trying to make a Cartesian move with this at this point. There's the significance of consciousness taking itself as an object. It's significant, and it's different somehow from taking other things as objects. And there seems to be so much bundled in it that he just kind of crams into those four sections before we get on to everything else. I was just trying to throw that out.
I think the point of these sections is that the awareness of life enriches the thin version of self-consciousness that we started with. So just to sum that all up, and if you look at 173, he says just that. In the course of its experience, which we are now to consider this abstract object, which will enrich itself for the I, the abstract conception of self-consciousness, and will undergo the unfolding which we have seen in the sphere of life. So we're starting with the thin version of self-consciousness, and now we're getting in an unfolding which will mirror the kinds of unfolding that happens in life. Life is a good example of, you know, where we started with our abstract self-consciousness. Life is a good example of concrete universals in natural kinds. That's my high-level take on all that, is the importance of our awareness of life to the enrichment of self-consciousness.
Yeah, Wes, I like your summation there. I don't know where the thin concept begins and the difference between thin and thick, whether it's developmental or logical or historical or what have you. But I like that.
I think there's also, in terms of Hegel's larger project here, the fact that the thinness of this concept of self is just that bare, either Cartesian or Kantian self, reflects Hegel's critique of enlightenment. He thinks that the enlightenment concept of selfhood is primitive. And ultimately, this is his kind of critique of modernity and mechanistic thinking in general. Selfhood was won through this difficult process, and it has this underbelly that's sort of ignored by the sort of standardized utilitarian concept of self that enlightenment has.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to throw a wacky interpretation in here, because this was my interpretation. I read this as a sophomore. This was actually my first philosophy course, because I was like in the honors program at the University of Michigan that they let you sign up for whatever course you want, even if you don't have the prereqs. I signed up for this contemporary continental course with Fritjof Bergmann that I had no business being in because I'd never taken another philosophy course. And this was virtually the first philosophy book I read in college, this section. And I was completely fascinated by it. And the reading that I gave it at the time, which I don't think is completely unique, you know, as we're talking about it in these commentaries we read, even though he's talking entirely abstractly, we're trying to put the everyday facts of life as we understand them into it. So when we talk about, oh, you gained a greater understanding of yourself, then we put in there, I identify myself as a father or something like that. Whereas the way that I read this initially was something more radical, that, for instance, when he's talking about life, we are just imposing, oh, he means living things, he means rabbits and stuff like this. But I was thinking of him defining life as anything that has this sort of internal reflections, anything that has enough complexity that we attribute autonomy to it, which is, in retrospect, a very Dan Dennett sort of stance, almost behaviorist. You know, so if the computer, again, it has eaten my homework and I start swearing at it, it's because it has enough complexity that it sort of is useful for me to think of it as having goals or something like that and addressing that on that level, as opposed to getting in and fiddling with my memory card or getting into the DOS or whatever crap like that. So that he's giving a really radical description of what life is, of what consciousness is. And in this section, the craziest thing about it is that it seems like we have a flexible notion of self. This idea that I am this body, there's something arbitrary about that. And we've seen that in Heidegger, that like if you're using a tool, it's like the tool becomes part of your body. I mean, there are even things on our bodies. Like I consider my fingernails part of my body, but I don't feel in my fingernails any more than I feel in the hammer that I'm holding. It's just merely a pragmatic convenience why I consider this part of myself and something else not part of myself. And so that the big point here is that we could have a self, maybe this is what spirit is all about, a self that is a group of people. This whole notion of organism is flexible. What spoke to me about this was reading about mystical experiences and people like, ooh, I experience myself as the cosmos, and saying, wow, maybe there's actually an ontological basis for this kind of experience. Maybe the seed of consciousness is to some extent arbitrary. The fact that we put it in just me as opposed to me plus this entire room and that's the organism or something like that.
Well, no doubt, you know, Hegel wants to justify the fact that thought is not simply in our brains. You know, it's in the world. And I think that the point about organism is really crucial too. I have this Cambridge companion to Hegel, and one of the essays says that basically, you know, if Hegel has an ultimate metaphysics of the universe, it's organism. And if you sort of disagree there, that's sort of where it falls. There's the clockwork universe, and then Hegel wants to say that in an organism, everything is related. The parts are all related to the whole, ultimately. So if that isn't right, then Hegel isn't right.
All right, next time we are going to talk more about this very same damn reading, but we will finally get to the lordship and bondage portion of chapter 4, or B.
We really have not gotten to the juicy bits. I mean, Master and Slave is just an awesome and phenomenal piece of work. Everything we've discussed now, it's too bad. It just doesn't compare to how awesome Master's.
All right. So listeners, if you are frustrated by the fact that we seem to only get through four pages of text and spend a lot of time talking about preliminary stuff that wasn't even supposed to be the focus of the episode, next time, that's when the juice will come.
I do not see how it would be possible for us to have a coherent conversation about the juicy part without having had salad first. So... In fact, I think what we talked about was juicy. Maybe it was a little leaner. It wasn't like the fatty part of the meat that's got all the flavor in it.
It was thin.
But it was moist.
It was a thin self.
If you're not going to take my bait on the self is flexible and the world is organism, fine. It'll be dry. Fine. Mystical man, I can eat some mushrooms and I can be this desk man.
Hegel on mushrooms is definitely better.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, thank you guys for inviting me. It's actually, it's a thrill because I really am a fan.
You are a tremendous and welcome addition. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Good night, everybody.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
And I go to meet you in Diane. I touch you when I take her hand. It seems immortal how you sit and watch me. Your eyes are blue, but show up green here. And I go to take you in, Joanne. She speaks your voice, I know she can. It's complicated how I'm faithful to you. I kiss her soft, I feel you breathe here. Sentimental monism or an unhealthy grieving for the long gone, or a mean, shallow way to use people on the fine strategy to move on, or a general desire to capture the moments, or a desperate attempt to feel secure, or a vicious betrayal of the others and self, or religious sublimation, I'm just not sure. Just what this says about us, me and I are staying with us. We can't even agree that these things are happening simultaneously. And who is who and what is red? And how do I know I'm not dead? With all these weapons in my head, they fight to get me to your bed. And I go to meet you in Suzanne. Without you, I am alone. Is shaped by you, dear. Dim sentimental monism, or an unhealthy grieving for the long gone, or a mean, shallow way to use people, or a fine strategy to move on, or a general design to capture the moment, or a desperate attempt to feel secure, or a vicious betrayal of the others and the self, or religious sublimation, I'm just not sure. Dim sentimental monism, or an unhealthy grieving for a long gone, or a mean, shallow way to use, or a fine strategy to move on, or a general desire to capture the moment, or a desperate attempt to feel secure, or a vicious betrayal of the others and the self, or religious sublimation, I'm just not sure. Dim sentimental monism, or an unhealthy grieving for a long gone, or a mean, shallow way to use, or a fine strategy to move on.